Session number 9796.
Mr. Spearman, reel 4.
And because there were too many people to go in the boat, a decision had to be made as to what to do. And I wasn't, of course, involved in any of the decision making. I was just a bod there on the beach. But what happened in the event, they found that the only thing they could do was to shoot some of the prisoners. And as you know, it's well documented that after the Dieppe raid, these bodies were found on the beach shot.
I think Hitler made a big issue of the fact that their hands were tied up. Can you say how that came about?
No, I can't say how that came about, but if we were to lumber ourselves with prisoners from the battery and get them back to England, we had to put them under some sort of control where they wouldn't unburden us or hold us up or be a danger or a risk or anything. So our plan was that we would put the hand behind their back and at the base of the thumbs to tie them tight with very fine twine, that if they were to make any effort at all, it would almost sever their thumbs. So this is what we did in order to get them back. We couldn't have gotten them back in any other way. They just moved along then under their own steam with the rest of us.
Were they cooperative in going back, or were they obstructive?
If they'd have been any way uncooperative, they wouldn't have lived to known it. By this time, as I say, before we even attacked the battery, they must have been so demoralised, I felt that if we'd have had a megaphone and offered them surrender, they may well have surrendered. So if you're asking me, after an attack by 300 finely trained troops, were they cooperative? There was no way they could be uncooperative. We had no time to discuss if they were going to cooperate. They weren't cooperative. It was all finely done. They were tied up. It was all done in a minute, and they were all taken back. But because we were limited with the boats, there were too many, and some of them had to be shot. And they were shot and they were left on the beach. And this was unfortunate because there's no way that any of us would have enjoyed shooting prisoners. I mean, it's not in the nature of an Englishman to do that. Even though the Germans and the Japanese did some terrible things of the war, I don't think that anybody would enjoy shooting a prisoner, especially people like us, because we weren't fighting because we were killers. We were just fighting to complete an operation. In any case, I wasn't involved in this decision making, as I said, and my time was I was really tensed up and very worried about crossing this open beach, because by this time there were Germans on top of the beach and we were under fire. So when I reached the AOC, I was utterly grateful to the Navy that they were there to take us away, and eventually we did get away. It wasn't finished then because there was a lot of aerial activity at the time going on. I don't think there was an overabundance of German planes around during the raid. In fact, I don't think that we had much opposition at all in that way. But at sea, with all the ships that were involved now in the main force going into Dieppe, this had stirred up everything, and there was a hell of a lot of aeroplanes in the sky, and we didn't feel part of that at this time, but we did see one plane, well, we saw a lot of planes shot up, but we saw one of our planes, or was it an American plane, I can't think, it must have been one of our planes, got shot up in the sky, and we saw the pilot leave the plane and the parachute open, and we went down and we picked the fella out of the water. You'd think I'd remember whether he was an American or an Englishman having done that, but I don't remember. We were all on a high and we just did this and took the fella on board and made our way back to New Haven, and grateful to be getting away from it all.
As you were crossing the beach going back, yes, were people being picked off by the Germans all the time?
Well, I can't remember the vision of bodies falling left and right, because we didn't swarm across the beach. If I remember rightly, when an AOC was on its way in, then there were a number of people detailed off, as it were, detailed off, I suppose, to make their way quickly to that thing. And I think we were very difficult targets. They were fired from high up the beach, from high up the cliffs, I should say. And the further you got away from the cliff, the more difficult a target you became, because your size receded, you know, and you were zigzagging and running like hell, you know, like... running like hell anyway. And so I can't remember bodies falling, and I can't remember having lost anybody there, because even now I'm not conscious of where people got shot or who they were. It's documented. You look up and you remember these things, you know, but I can't remember people falling left, right and centre as we ran along the beach. All I know is that we would have been running extremely fast. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if some running records weren't broken, as you can imagine. But, of course, people who were carrying stretchers, of course, couldn't do that, you know. So I can't answer that question. I know it was quite a frightening experience, because, as I say, going on a raid, you're on a high and nothing happens. It's like when, towards the end of the war, the last thing you want to do is get killed. And when a raid's over and you've gone through all that, all you want to do is to get back. You'd all be killed at the last minute, you know. I can't remember whether people got shot on that beach, but it was a desperate situation, I know. All we had to do now was to get away, and the boats were there, so that was that. It was lovely. Yeah, because we weren't conscious of what was happening as far as the Canadians were concerned. But, if I make a quick comment here, which I'd like to do, about the main assault on Dieppe, having read the books and speaking of various brigadiers and that since the war, and I keep referring back to Lord Lovett's book, because he was the young, brave officer in charge of our commander. I have the greatest respect for him. When I read the stories he told about the raids and everything, which I was on with him, I know him to be a fairly accurate recordist of what actually happened. And I think he's a good military man. Is that? No, he's a good military man. So I pay a lot of attention to what he says, and I agree with what he says, that Dieppe raid plan to introduce all these 5,000 Canadians, what it was, to do this assault on Dieppe. Originally, it was supposed to be a pincer movement on Dieppe. And this is the obvious way, as far as a commander is concerned, of taking a heavily defended port like Dieppe, would be to isolate it. To do a pincer movement, all our training, you didn't do a frontal assault unless it was absolutely essential. And not having said that, they'd had people look at that beach, and they knew the shingle was large shingle, and these tanks couldn't get a grip on this thing, and they couldn't get off the beach. They'd have the greatest difficulty in getting off a beach with that shingle on. Getting off a beach, and it was overhung with guns. They knew this. There was a gun battery right in the middle of Dieppe, almost, overlooking all the beach. And the obvious thing would have been to isolate it. And this was the original plan. At the very last moment, and I don't know for what reason, that's been documented in other places, but for some reason they decided at the last minute to make it a frontal assault. And this was absolutely 100% suicidal, when you knew they were going to land 30 or 40 tanks on the beach. There was no way could they get off the beach. And to put in 5,000 or 6,000 people who'd never been in action again, or before, who'd never been in action before, people don't know that when you go into action it's the most frightening experience. To suddenly come on a beach and to be under severe fire, and it's only people who'd never really known this sort of thing could even contemplate making that raid on Dieppe a frontal assault. And so it was, because nobody, even now, there were thousands lost, and people never know. They'd never been in action before, these people, and to do that was absolutely suicidal, and people never know what the Canadians suffered. And to think that nobody ever got punished for making a stupid decision like that. And this has been the history throughout the war, the workers go and do the fighting, and they're led by generals and that, who these days would be put in the bloody asylum where they came up with suggestions like it.
Now, after the Dieppe raid, was that the last of the small-scale raids that you participated in?
Number 4 Commander didn't do another raid after that until the Second Front, I don't think.
So between August 1942,
yes,
and June 1944, what were you doing in that period of about 2 years?
Yeah, quite right. Well, I went on a parallel, coming up towards the Second Front. With the Second Front in mind, they decided that when the invasion took place, that the commandos would be going in, obviously with a parachute division, and there would need to be some liaison on that sort of thing. And they decided somewhere along the line that they wanted they would like one troop to be a parachute troop in the commando, so that we could jump in with the paratroopers in order to make the tie-up easier and this sort of thing. So that's one of the things that happened during that time. I personally and 30 other people went on the parachute course in Ringway and did our jumps. We were very fit, so we did the whole thing in 2 weeks, I believe. Did 9 jumps each. What else did we do during that period? Did I make a little note? Yes, apart from the parachute course, I've already mentioned that when I went to Scotland in pursuance of this sniping situation. That was another thing we did. We did various things. If I recall now, another thing we did, I think we were asked to try out some folding parachute bicycles. My memory is very vague on this, but I think when we were in Troon, we were given these folding bicycles and asked to cycle down to Cockermouth in the Lake District. We had to cycle from Glasgow or Troon or wherever on these folding bicycles to see whether they're any good or not. This is a vague memory anyway, but I do know that we got to Cockermouth anyway.
Were they any good?
Yes, they were good, but they weren't for us, you know. I can't remember what the overall report on them was or not. I can't remember. But I do remember our time in Cockermouth. We went on with our normal training there. I could tell you one or two private little episodes here that were very funny, and I'll just pick out one, because when we got there, we were again put into civilian billets, and we arrived there rather late at night. If I remember rightly, early in the morning, and the landladies, God bless them, were there to meet us, and I was allocated with a colleague of mine to go to this Tudor Cafe. This woman who owned was a restaurant called the Tudor Cafe. And it was we went into this house in the dead of night, and we were very dirty and rough and everything else, and the carpets, I remember, were very thick, and when you walked on them, you sunk into it, you know, and you felt completely out of place in such a nice standard home when you were in rough soldiers' clothes and all this sort of thing. And we were shown then, we declined a meal because of the trouble it would take at that time in the morning, but she insisted on making us something. And having had that, then she showed us to our room, a twin-bedded room, and the beds were divided by a little bedside closet, as it always is. And of course, everybody smoked in those days, and we had to have the cigarette, even though we felt it out of place smoking in a nice place like that. We did have to have a smoke. And as we were smoking, we investigated this cabin in between us, and we opened the door, and there was a chamber pot in there. And all we could see on the side of it was a bloody great eyeball looking at you. And this, of course, raised our curiosity. I can't remember who I was with now, but we took it out, and the house was dead silent. You could hear a pin drop because of all this thick carpeting, and being so early in the morning, everybody was... We pulled out this pot, and as we put it off, it released a trigger mechanism on the bottom of the pot, and it started playing what seemed to be bloody loud, "Old Landlord, fill the flowing bowl until it's flowing over." You know that song?
Yes.
And it took us a minute or two to find out you had to put it down and stop the bloody music. And inside the pot, there was a raised portion with another eyeball looking up. There were all sorts of, not obscene, but, you know, bloody suggestive bloody pictures on this. Anyway, we thought it was very funny, but we were completely ashamed to think that we were going to pass water in such a nice house. Anyway, we wouldn't have done it, you know. But the only reason I mentioned that one, because we were in Cockermouth for a fortnight. And before we left, the whole troop lined up, and we took this chamber pot at the head of the column, and we all went round Cockermouth singing, "Oh, Landlord, fill the flowing bowl," through the street. So that was quite a funny episode then, you know. And what else did we do? Well, the other thing I remember that we did, well, we went training. We went to the Hebrides, we went to Stornoway, we went to various islands doing courses and things like that, pursuing our training, long distance marching. And of course, it must have been about this period when we went to Scotland with these mules. probably that filled in that time. But all I can say for that missing period where I haven't mentioned too much is my recall is very poor at this stage, but there was never a dull moment. We went everywhere, quite honestly, training, and but we never actually went active anywhere, because at the time the whole period seemed to be spent in preparing for specific operations which at the last minute were postponed. And there was this political trouble about the Second Front. Were we going to go in and do a Second Front just to pacify Russia, you know, or were we going to get completely 100% ready before we did it? There was all this controversy going on, and of course Lovett was always getting upset when other commanders were given raids and we weren't given raids, you know. We're looking back, it was always a question of, we were always training, we were always ready to go, but to keep finely honed troops like that, really finely honed to be ready at any time, you had to do nothing but training all the time. And some of the things we did were, and we had to do speed marches, and I remember one occasion some Americans came over because they didn't believe you could walk at 6 miles an hour loaded with all your kit, and of course they asked for volunteers to do this, of which I was one, and we had to load our pack on our back, and demonstrate to these Americans, in wherever it was in Troon, that we did this 6 miles an hour walking with our rifles and all our heavy equipment. You know, things like this went on the whole time. I can't think of all the things that didn't go on.
Can you tell me about the preparations you made for D-Day now?
Yes, D-Day. That was the big D-Day landing on Normandy. Well, on the run-up to D-Day, our training was continued. We became fitter and fitter. There was a lot of talk for many months about an invasion of France and the opening of the Second Front. But our life was riddled with talks of this raid or talks of that raid. And we never really got excited about the whole thing, because it was part of our life to have raids coming on and this sort of thing. And it wasn't until almost the last moment, coming up to D-Day, when we were transported lock, stock and barrel, except for personal good, which we were asked to send to our home addresses to get rid of. And we knew then that something, somewhere along a raid, was going to happen, because when you go on a raid, you didn't clear your digs out, as it were, where you were living in digs. You used to leave the stuff there and come back to them. But on D-Day, I remember, when I think hard about it, I remember them saying to us, I can't remember what they said to us, but I do remember making a point of wrapping certain things up and either leaving with the landlady to send to my home address or send them to my home address. So we did realise that all the talk of the Second Front and Russia's pressure to open up a Second Front was going to come. And then at the last minute we're all transported into a South Coast camp, a temporary military type camp with a lot of other people, and we guessed that this was the real thing. And there was a lot of excitement being in this camp, as opposed to being in civilian digs where we'd normally been. And the preparation for it went on. It was a hassling time. I don't recall too much of the details of that. I do remember at the last minute then leaving land and getting onto a boat, and we all know now that this preparation for D-Day, where so many ships were involved in the channel, that everybody, they were trying to work it so that from air reconnaissance by the Germans couldn't easily identify that something was happening. But it's very difficult to believe, looking back, how they could assemble such a fleet as they must have had to assemble along the South Coast, and the Germans not to know about it coming. Although it didn't tell them where we were going to go, of course. So I can't remember too many details. We found ourselves on this boat. There were delays, and we all know the thing was put back 24 hours. I can't really remember how that really affected us. We were all, as every other raid before us, home to do a raid, and came the morning when we started off, and there was a little bit of trepidation, not about the raid so much, because compared with an ordinary small raid by the commander or a few of the commandos, on this occasion you felt that no matter what happened, the whole Air Force, the whole Army, the whole Navy, the whole people were coming after you. You weren't an isolated bunch of people. It was a big invasion. It was going to be big. So there was less trepidation in that way. The one thing we did worry about was the weather. And on the day that it really happened, the sea, as you know, was very rough, even though I believe it calmed down from the previous day, but it was a rough day. And we'd done quite a little bit of work on ships and that, but I don't think people got used to boats and weren't seasick. All I know is that if you do get seasick, you'd rather die than continue the journey. And I suppose with a lot of people, you could feel that no matter what the opposition was like when you reached the raid, where you were going to do the raid, to get off the boat must have been wonderful, you know, rather than to continue with that seasickness. Anyhow, on this journey across the channel to Dieppe, we were in the big mothership at the time. I can't remember what it was. But I do believe it was one of the ones that we'd used a number of times when we were in Scotland and stored away in the Hebrides, the Queen Emma, or there are a couple of ships, I made a note of them here. There's a Queen Emma, the Princess Astrid, or the Beatrix. They were three boats we were quite familiar with because we'd done all our training, all our seaborne training in Scotland on them. And I think it was one of those boats. We felt quite at home in this boat and we knew the Navy people. And going across the channel, of course, the enormity of everything began to become apparent because no matter which way you looked, you found ships of all shapes and sizes and warships and merchant ships like we were on, in every direction, as far as the eye could see. On an ordinary raid, you just wouldn't see this sort of thing. You'd be chugging along, knowing there was nothing else chugging except yourself, but here everything was chugging. And as we neared the French coast, on our left, to our east in other words, not too far away from us, we saw suddenly one ship explode into the air and sank, all in a few minutes. So we assumed this must have hit some big mine, which we accentuated the knowledge that they had mined the coast. And of course we were led by minesweepers. But I suppose if you think about it, the minesweeper, it would be very hard for a minesweeper to remove every mine. So I think a number of ships were sunk on this passage over by mines. And I suppose when you're working like the commandos work, we had strict instructions of what we had to do. We were on the complete left flank, the complete east flank of the whole of the landing. And our first job, because we were used to knocking batteries out of action, our first job was to knock out a gun battery at a place called Wistingham, which was right on the east side of the landing. And then after that, we were to take up positions in the Hawger area, a few miles inland, and defend that against all comers. And if our boat had sunk, I really don't know who would have taken over that job because there were no reserves for us. It was a very thin green line that we set up on that. Who would have knocked out the gun battery? Who would have defended that left flank? There was nobody in reserve. I suppose in a way there were a lot of fortune and a lot of misfortune went on. And anyway, our boat travelled safely until the time came to get into our AOCs. And we were the forefront of our commando, or the forefront of the other commandos, I think, in our one. And we had steel-hulled AOCs. And I think some of the boats, they weren't steel-hulled. I'm not quite sure about that point. But we felt safe in these ones. You got a sense of security being in these AOCs, which were made of steel, real solid things. But all our attention was drawn to the whole magnitude of the whole operation, left and right, everywhere, all these bloody great ships. They seemed to be everywhere. And then bombers going over all the time. Well documented now that our Air Force, of course, softened up everything. But when we actually made the landing, you would never dream that they'd been softened up. Whether they had been or not, I don't know, but there was the troops had landed in front of us, 3rd Brigade, East Lancashire Regiment or something like that. I'm uncertain about that point. But they, like I've mentioned about Canadian before, had never been on an assault landing before. And in retrospect, going through all that and other things afterwards, I often wonder whether they were put there as sort of gun fodder to distract their attention for us to go in, because we were always the people who went in first, did a sharp, quick raid and got out again. Seemed to change here. They put those East Lancashire people in, or the, whatever, whoever they were that went in, and they never even left the beach. Just like I was saying about Dieppe, people, planners, they might have gone through a lot of campaigns at a very high level, but nobody can know what it's like to be on a beach where you can do nothing, where you're under severe fire and you've got to get off. And it's only a person who's been through it a number of times can know you've either got to die, stay and die, or get off and live. People doing it for the first time, no matter how many times you tell them, they don't realise it. And nobody got off the beach. And as we were coming in, because we were lucky to even land, because some of the boats, as they went in, got blown out of the water long before they reached there. The motherships got blown up, the transporters got blown up. So you're under tremendous fire going in, but luck was with us and we landed on the beach. We had tremendous weight on our backs. Somewhere half hundredweight. There was an average of what we had on our backs. We had flamethrowers, we had shells. The idea was we had enough food, enough things to support ourselves for 3 months, in case we didn't get reinforcements or if we didn't get replenished. And I think we had sort of 2 or 3 months' supply of things on our back, as well as all our weaponry. And we know, and I personally know because I actually did lay down, once you get down with that pack in your back, you can't get up again. Yeah, and of course, if you elongate yourself on a beach, underneath cliffs or underneath a high road behind, you elongate the target. You're much easier to hit. So the idea, we're all fit and thin, and to stand up, you present a much lesser target than somebody laying down. But I was shocked by the number of bodies, dead bodies, living bodies, and all the blood in the water give you the appearance they were drowning in their own blood for the want of moving. The whole place was littered like it. There were great, monstrous fortifications on the beach, like tremendous, I don't know, cubes or crisscross steels, girders to stop gliders landing, to stop ships coming in. There were girders penetrating into the beach, sticking up to stop boats coming in. And the whole beach area was supposed to be, and in fact was, covered by flamethrowers. It was a desperate situation. But I think domineering the whole place were these tremendous big pillboxes. I don't know how frequent they were, but no matter where you went, you couldn't get out of range of them. They covered the beach very well. The fortifications were excellent. And if you think of a pillbox, you can go up to it, go to a slit and drop a grenade in. It's all very well. But these bloody defences they had on the beach there, they had about a dozen slits in them. They were tremendous things. And our job wasn't to stop and put them out of action. Our job was to get off the beach and get onto this gun battery. We had one object in mind, to get off the bloody beach. And it was quite terrifying, the enormity of everything, having seen all the bodies on the beach, doubled our determination. No matter what happened, we had to get off the beach. Once you get off the beach, you were out of the fire, as it were. It was a very hard lesson to learn, and people bloody won't learn it. And why the powers to be, I criticise them on this, why they may have served a purpose which I can't see, but to put so many untrained troops on that D-Day landing on the beach first, any one of us could tell you they wouldn't get off. They'd be so transfixed with fright they couldn't get off. We, of course, were transfixed with fright, but we had the certain knowledge that you either stopped and died or you went off and got away. So we took the coward's view and got off the bloody place. Although, of course, some of our people did try to put some of these things out of action on the way. I remember one Lieutenant Carr, terribly thin man, but a very good officer, and he deliberately went up to one pillbox and threw a couple of grenades, and I thought it was a very brave deed just to hesitate in order to do that, because they did have a little bit of all-round fire, these pillboxes. They weren't just